Jim Collins, the author of the business classic Good to Great, was once told by Peter Drucker that he could either build a great company or build great ideas, but not both. Jim chose ideas. As a result of this trade-off, there are still only 3 full-time employees in his company, yet his ideas have reached tens of millions of people through his writing. As painful as they can sometimes be, trade-offs represent a significant opportunity. By forcing us to weigh both options and strategically select the best one for us, we significantly increase our chance of achieving the outcome we want. Like Southwest, we can enjoy the success that results from making a consistent set of choices. I observed an example of this on a recent flight to Boston when I began chatting with 2 parents who were on their way to visit their son at Harvard. They were clearly proud their son was there, and I was curious about what strategy they and he had pursued in getting him accepted. They said, "We had him try out a lot of things, but as soon as it became clear an activity was not going to be his big thing, we discussed it and took him out of it." The point here is not that all parents should want their children to go to Harvard. The point is that these essentialist parents had consciously decided their goal was for their son to go to Harvard and understood that that success required making strategic trade-offs. This logic holds true in our personal lives as well. When we were newlyweds, Anna and I met someone who had, as far as we could tell, an amazing marriage and family. We wanted to learn from him, so we asked him, "What's your secret?" One of the things he told us was that he and his wife had decided not to be part of any clubs. He didn't join the local lodge. She didn't join the book clubs. It wasn't that they had no interest in those things. It was simply that they made the trade-off to spend that time with their children. Over the years, their children had become their best friends, well worth the sacrifice of any friendships that they might have made on the golf course or over tattered copies of Anna Karenina. Essentialists see trade-offs as an inherent part of life, not as an inherently negative part of life. Instead of asking, "What do I have to give up?" they ask, "What do I want to go big on?" The cumulative impact of this small change in thinking can be profound. A non-essentialist thinks, "I can do both." An essentialist asks, "What is the trade-off I want to make?" A non-essentialist asks, "How can I do it all?" An essentialist asks, "What can I go big on?" In a piece called Laugh Kookaburra, published in The New Yorker, David Sedaris gives a humorous account of his experience touring the Australian bush. While hiking, his friend and guide for the day shares something that she heard in passing at a management class. "Imagine a 4-burner stove," she instructs the members of the party. "One burner represents your family, one is your friends, the third is your health, and the fourth is your work. In order to be successful, you have to cut off one of your burners. And in order to be really successful, you have to cut off 2. Of course, this was tongue-in-cheek. I am not here to suggest that living the way of the essentialist requires us to decide between our families and our health and our work. What I am suggesting is that when faced with a decision where one option prioritizes family and another prioritizes friends, health, or work, we need to be prepared to ask, which problem do you want? Trade-offs are not something to be ignored or decried. They are something to be embraced and made deliberately, strategically, and thoughtfully. Explore. How can we discern the trivial many from the vital few? One paradox of essentialism is that essentialists actually explore more options than their non-essentialist counterparts. Non-essentialists get excited by virtually everything and thus react to everything. But because they are so busy pursuing every opportunity and idea, they actually explore less. The way of the essentialist, on the other hand, is to explore and evaluate a broad set of options before committing to any. Because essentialists will commit and go big on only the vital few ideas or activities, they explore more options at first to ensure they pick the right one later. In part 2, we will discuss 5 practices for exploring what is essential. The gravitational pull of non-essentialism can be so strong that it can be tempting to skip over or skim over this step. Yet this step in itself is essential to the disciplined pursuit of less. To discern what is truly essential, we need space to think, time to look and listen, permission to play, wisdom to sleep, and the discipline to apply highly selective criteria to the choices we make. Ironically, in a non-essentialist culture, these things, space, listening, playing, sleeping, and selecting, can be seen as trivial distractions. At best, they are considered nice to have. At worst, they are derided as evidence of weakness and wastefulness. We all know that highly ambitious or productive person who thinks, "Of course, I'd love to be able to set aside time on the calendar simply to think, but it's a luxury we can't afford right now." Or, "Play? Who has time to play? We are here to work." Or as one leader said to me in an onboarding process, "I hope you had a good night's sleep. You won't get much of that here." If you believe being overly busy and overextended is evidence of productivity, then you probably believe that creating space to explore, think, and reflect should be kept to a minimum. Yet these very activities are the antidote to the non-essential busyness that infects so many of us. Rather than trivial diversions, they are critical to distinguishing what is actually a trivial diversion from what is truly essential. Essentialists spend as much time as possible exploring, listening, debating, questioning, and thinking. But their exploration is not an end in itself. The purpose of the exploration is to discern the vital few from the trivial many. Chapter 5. Escape. The perks of being unavailable. Without great solitude, no serious work is possible. Pablo Picasso. Frank O'Brien is the founder of Conversations, a marketing services company based in New York that has been named to the Inc. 500 5000 list of America's fastest-growing private companies. In response to the frenetic pace of today's workplace, he has initiated a radical practice. Once a month, he gathers each employee of his 50-person company into a room for a full day. Phones are prohibited. Email is outlawed. There is no agenda. The purpose of the meeting is simply to escape, to think, and to talk. Mind you, he doesn't hold this meeting on the middle Friday of the month, when productivity might be sluggish and people aren't getting any real work done anyway. He holds this day-long meeting on the first Monday of the month. The practice isn't just an internal discipline either. Even his clients know not to expect a response on this "Do Not Call Monday." He does this because he knows his people can't figure out what is essential if they're constantly on call. They need space to figure out what really matters. He wrote, "I think it's critical to set aside time to take a breath, look around, and think. You need that level of clarity in order to innovate and grow." Furthermore, he uses the meeting as a litmus test to alert him if employees are spending too much time on the non-essential. He says, "If somebody can't make the meeting because too much is going on, that tells me either we're doing something inefficiently or we need to hire more people." If his people are too busy to think, then they're too busy, period. We need space to escape in order to discern the essential few from the trivial many. Unfortunately, in our time-starved era, we don't get that space by default, only by design. One leader I worked with admitted to staying at a company 5 years too long. Why? Because he was so busy in the company, he didn't take time to decide whether he should be at the company. The demands of each day kept him from really stepping back to get perspective. Similarly, a senior vice president at a major global technology company told me he spends 35 hours every week in meetings. He is so consumed with these meetings, he cannot find even an hour a month to strategize about his own career, let alone how to take his organization to the next level. Instead of giving himself the space to talk and debate what is really going on and what really needs to happen, he squanders his time sitting through endless presentations and stuffy, cross-functional conversations where nothing is really decided. Before you can evaluate what is and isn't essential, you first need to explore your options. While non-essentialists automatically react to the latest idea, jump on the latest opportunity, or respond to the latest email, essentialists choose to create the space to explore and ponder. A non-essentialist is too busy doing to think about life. An essentialist creates space to escape and explore life. Space to design. The value of creating space to explore has been emphasized for me in my work with the D School at Stanford, officially the Hasso-Plattner Institute of Design at Stanford. The first thing I noticed when I walked into the room where I had been asked to teach a course was the lack of traditional chairs. Instead, there are foam cubes you can sit on, rather uncomfortably, as I soon discovered. Like almost everything at the D School, this is done by design. In this case, the cubes are there so that after a few minutes of uncomfortable perching, students would rather stand up, walk around, and engage with one another, not just the classmates sitting to their right or to their left. And that is the point. The school has used the physical space to encourage new ways of engaging and thinking. To that end, the school has also created a hiding place called Booth Noir. This is a small room deliberately designed to fit only 1 to 3 people. It is windowless, soundproof, and deliberately free of distraction. It is, according to Scott Dorley and Scott Withoft, in their book Make Space, beyond low tech, it's no tech. It's tucked away on the ground floor. It is not, as Dorley and Withoft point out, on the way to anywhere else. The only reason you go there is to think. By creating space to think and focus, students can step back to see more clearly. For some reason, there is a false association with the word focus. As with choice, people tend to think of focus as a thing. Yes, focus is something we have, but focus is also something we do. In order to have focus, we need to escape to focus. When I say focus, I don't simply mean picking a question or possibility and thinking about it obsessively. I mean creating the space to explore 100 questions and possibilities. An essentialist focuses the way our eyes focus, not by fixating on something, but by constantly adjusting and adapting to the field of vision. On a recent meeting back at the D School, in another room with no seats or desks but with whiteboards from floor to ceiling covered with post-its of every fathomable color, I met with Jeremy Utley. He is my partner in developing a new prototyped class that, in a moment of genius, Jeremy dubbed Designing Life Essentially. The sole purpose of the class is to create space for students to design their lives. Each week it gives them a scheduled excuse to think. They are forced to turn off their laptops and smartphones and instead to turn on the full power of their minds. They are given assignments to practice deliberately discerning the essential few from the many good. You don't have to be at the D School to practice these habits. We can all learn to create more space in our lives. Space to concentrate. One executive I know is intelligent and driven, but constantly distracted. At any given time, he will have Twitter, Gmail, Facebook, and multiple IM conversations going at once. In an effort to create a distraction-free space, he once tried to have his executive assistant pull all the internet cables on his computer. But he still found too many ways to get online. So when he was struggling to complete a particularly big project, he resorted to a desperate measure. He gave his phone away and went to a motel with no internet access. After 8 weeks of almost solitary confinement, he was able to get the project done. To me, it is a little sad that this executive was driven to such measures. Yet while his methods may have been extreme, I can't argue with his intention. He knew that making his highest point of contribution on a task required that he create the space for unencumbered thought. Think of Sir Isaac Newton. He spent 2 years working on what became Principia Mathematica, his famous writings on universal gravitation and the three laws of motion. This period of almost solitary confinement proved critical in what became a true breakthrough that shaped scientific thinking for the next 300 years. Richard S. Westphal has written, In the age of his celebrity, Newton was asked how he had discovered the law of universal gravitation. "By thinking on it continually," was the reply. What he thought on continually, which is to say exclusively or nearly exclusively. In other words, Newton created space for intense concentration, and this uninterrupted space enabled him to explore the essential elements of the universe. Inspired by Newton, I took a similar, if perhaps less extreme, approach to writing this book. I blocked off 8 hours a day to write from 5 a.m. to 1 p.m., 5 days a week. The basic rule was no email, no calls, no appointments, and no interruptions until after 1 p.m. I didn't always achieve it, but the discipline made a big difference. I set my email bounce back to explain that I was in monk mode until after the book was complete. It is difficult to overstate how much freedom I found in this approach. By creating space to explore, think, and write, I not only got my book done faster, but gained control over how I spent the rest of my time. It seems obvious, but when did you last take time out of your busy day simply to sit and think? I don't mean the 5 minutes during your morning commute you spent composing the day's to-do list, or the meeting you spent zoned out reflecting on how to approach another project you were working on. I'm talking about deliberately setting aside distraction-free time in a distraction-free space to do absolutely nothing other than think. This is, of course, more difficult today than ever in our gadget-filled, overstimulated world. One leader at Twitter once asked me, "Can you remember what it was like to be bored? It doesn't happen anymore." He's right. Just a few years ago, if you were stuck in the airport waiting for a delayed flight, or in the waiting room of a doctor's office, you probably just sat there, staring into space, feeling bored. Today, everyone waiting around in an airport or a waiting room is glued to their technology tools of choice. Of course, nobody likes to be bored. But by abolishing any chance of being bored, we have also lost the time we used to have to think and process. Here's another paradox for you. The faster and busier things get, the more we need to build thinking time into our schedule. And the noisier things get, the more we need to build quiet reflection spaces in which we can truly focus. No matter how busy you think you are, you can carve time and space to think out of your workday. Jeff Weiner, the CEO of LinkedIn, for example, schedules up to 2 hours of blank space on his calendar every day. He divides them into 30-minute increments, yet he schedules nothing. It is a simple practice he developed when back-to-back meetings left him with little time to process what was going on around him. At first it felt like an indulgence, a waste of time, but eventually he found it to be his single most valuable productivity tool. He sees it as the primary way he can ensure he is in charge of his own day instead of being at the mercy of it. As he explained to me, "I do recall one particular day where, by virtue of circumstances, I was either on conference calls or in meetings non-stop from 5 a.m. until 9 p.m. At the end of the day, I remember how frustrated I felt by the thought that I was not in control of my schedule that day. Rather, it was in control of me." However, that frustration immediately gave way to a sense of gratitude, given it was the only day I could recall feeling like that since taking my current role. In this space, he is able to think about the essential questions. What the company will look like in 3 to 5 years? What's the best way to improve an already popular product or address an unmet customer need? How to widen a competitive advantage or close a competitive gap? He also uses the space he creates to recharge himself emotionally. This allows him to shift between problem-solving mode and the coaching mode expected of him as a leader. For Jeff, creating space is more than a practice. It is part of a broader philosophy. He has seen the effects of the undisciplined pursuit of more on organizations and in the lives of executives. So for him, it's not a slogan or a buzz phrase. It is a philosophy. Space to read. We can take further inspiration from the example of Bill Gates, who regularly, and famously, takes a regular week off from his daily duties simply to think and read. I once attended a question and answer session with Bill at the headquarters of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation in Seattle, Washington. By chance, he had just completed his latest Think Week. Though I had heard about this practice, what I didn't know was that it goes all the way back to the 1980s and that he stuck to it through the height of Microsoft's expansion. In other words, twice a year, during the busiest and most frenetic time in the company's history, he still created time and space to seclude himself for a week and do nothing but read articles. His record is 112. And books, study technology, and think about the bigger picture. Today he still takes the time away from the daily distractions of running his foundation to simply think. If setting aside a full week seems overwhelming or impossible, there are ways of putting a little think week into every day. One practice I've found useful is simply to read something from classic literature, not a blog or the newspaper or the latest beach novel, for the first 20 minutes of the day. Not only does this squash my previous tendency to check my email as soon as I wake up, it centers my day. It broadens my perspective and reminds me of themes and ideas that are essential enough to have withstood the test of time. My preference is for inspirational literature, though such a choice is a personal one. But for the interested, here are some to consider. Zen, The Reason of Unreason. The Wisdom of Confucius. The Torah. The Holy Bible. Tao, To Know and Not Be Knowing. The Meaning of the Glorious Quran, An Explanatory Translation. As a Man Thinketh. The Essential Gandhi. Walden, or Life in the Woods, The Book of Mormon, The Meditations of Marcus Aurelius, and The Upanishads. There are a myriad of options. Just make sure to select something that was written before our hyperconnected era and yet seems timeless. Such writings can challenge our assumptions about what really matters. Whether you can invest 2 hours a day, 2 weeks a year, or even just 5 minutes every morning, it is important to make space to escape in your busy life. Chapter 6. Look. See what really matters. Where is the knowledge we have lost in information? T.S. Eliot. The late writer Nora Ephron is arguably best known for movies like Silkwood, Sleepless in Seattle, and When Harry Met Sally, each of which was nominated for an Academy Award. Ephron's success as a writer and screenwriter has a lot to do with her ability to capture the essence of a story, a skill she honed in her earlier career as a journalist. But for all her years in the high-octane world of journalism, the lesson that affected her most profoundly dates all the way back to her high school years. Charlie O. Sims taught a Journalism 101 class in Beverly Hills High School. He started the first day of the class Ephron attended much the same way any journalism teacher would, by explaining the concept of a lead. He explained that a lead contains the why, what, when, and who of the piece. It covers the essential information. Then he gave them their first assignment: write a lead to a story. Sims began by presenting the facts of the story. Kenneth L. Peters, the principal of Beverly Hills High School, announced today that the entire high school faculty will travel to Sacramento next Thursday for a colloquium in new teaching methods. Among the speakers will be anthropologist Margaret Mead, college president Dr. Robert Maynard Hutchins, and California Governor Edmund Pat Brown. The students hammered away on their manual typewriters, trying to keep up with the teacher's pace. Then they handed in their rapidly written leads. Each attempted to summarize the who, what, where, and why as succinctly as possible. Margaret Mead, Maynard Hutchins, and Governor Brown will address the faculty on next Thursday. The high school faculty will. Sims reviewed the students' leads and put them aside. He then informed them that they were all wrong. The lead to the story, he said, was, "There will be no school Thursday." In that instant, Ephron recalls, "I realized that journalism was not just about regurgitating the facts, but about figuring out the point. It wasn't enough to know the who, what, when and where. You had to understand what it meant and why it mattered. Efron added, "He taught me something that works just as well in life as it does in journalism. In every set of facts, something essential is hidden. And a good journalist knows that finding it involves exploring those pieces of information and figuring out the relationships between them. And my undergraduate degree is in journalism, so I take this seriously. It means making those relationships and connections explicit. It means constructing the whole from the sum of its parts, and understanding how these different pieces come together to matter to anyone. The best journalists do not simply relay information. Their value is in discovering what really matters to people." Have you ever felt lost and unsure about what to focus on? Have you ever felt overwhelmed by all the information bombarding you and not sure what to make of it? Have you ever felt dizzy from the different requests coming at you and unable to figure out which are important and which are not? Have you ever missed the point to something in your work or at home and not realized your mistake until it was too late? If so, this next essentialist skill will be immensely valuable. The big picture. On December 29th, 1972, Eastern Airlines Flight 401 crashed into the Florida Everglades, killing over 100 passengers. It was the first ever crash of a wide-body aircraft and one of the worst airline crashes in U.S. history. The investigators were later shocked to discover that, in all vital ways, the plane had been in perfect working condition. So what went wrong? The Lockheed jet had been preparing to land when First Officer Albert Stockstill noticed that the landing gear indicator, a tiny green light that signals the nose gear is locked down, hadn't lit up. Yet the nose gear was locked. The problem was the indicator light, not the gear function. While the officers were hyper-focused on the gear indicator, however, they failed to notice that the autopilot had been deactivated until it was too late. In other words, the nose gear didn't cause the disaster, the crew's losing sight of the bigger problem, the altitude of the plane, did. Being a journalist of your own life will force you to stop hyper-focusing on all the minor details and see the bigger picture. You can apply the skills of a journalist no matter what field you are in. You can even apply them to your personal life. By training yourself to look for the lead, you will suddenly find yourself able to see what you have missed. You'll be able to do more than simply see the dots of each day. You'll also connect them to see the trends. Instead of just reacting to the facts, you'll be able to focus on the larger issues that really matter. Filter for the fascinating. We know instinctively that we cannot explore every single piece of information we encounter in our lives. Discerning what is essential to explore requires us to be disciplined in how we scan and filter all the competing and conflicting facts, options, and opinions constantly vying for our attention. Recently, I chatted with Thomas Friedman, the New York Times columnist and award-winning journalist, about how to filter the essential information from the non-essential noise. Before I met with him, he had been at a lunch meeting with sources for a column he was writing. Someone at lunch thought, at first, that he was not paying attention to the banter at the table. But he was listening. He was taking in the whole conversation at the table. He was simply filtering out everything other than those things that really grabbed his attention. Then he tried to connect the dots by asking lots of questions only about what had just piqued his interest. The best journalists, as Friedman shared later with me, listen for what others do not hear. At the lunch, he had been listening for what was being said only at the periphery. He was listening more for what was not being said. Essentialists are powerful observers and listeners. Knowing that the reality of trade-offs means they can't possibly pay attention to everything, they listen deliberately for what is not being explicitly stated. They read between the lines. Or as Hermione Granger of Harry Potter fame, an unlikely essentialist I'll grant you, but an essentialist in this regard all the same, puts it, "Actually, I'm highly logical, which allows me to look past extraneous detail and perceive clearly that which others overlook." Non-essentialists listen too, but they listen while preparing to say something. They get distracted by extraneous noise. They hyper-focus on inconsequential details. They hear the loudest voice, but they get the wrong message. In their eagerness to react, they miss the point. As a result, they may, using a metaphor from C.S. Lewis, run around with fire extinguishers in times of flood. They miss the lead. A non-essentialist pays attention to the loudest voice. An essentialist pays attention to the signal in the noise. A non-essentialist hears everything being said. An essentialist hears what is not being said. A non-essentialist is overwhelmed by all the information. An essentialist scans to find the essence of the information. In the chaos of the modern workplace, with so many loud voices all around us pulling us in many directions, it is more important now than ever that we learn to resist the siren song of distraction and keep our eyes and ears peeled for the headlines. Here are a few ways to tap into your inner journalist. Keep a journal. Stating the obvious, the words journal and journalist come from the same root word. A journalist is, in the word's most literal sense, someone who writes a journal. Therefore, one of the most obvious and yet powerful ways to become a journalist of our own lives is simply to keep a journal. The sad reality is that we humans are forgetful creatures. I would even go so far as to say shockingly forgetful. Don't believe me? You can test this theory right now by trying to recall from memory what you ate for dinner 2 weeks ago on Thursday. Or ask yourself what meetings you attended 3 weeks ago on Monday. If you are like most people, you will draw a total blank on this exercise. Think of a journal as like a storage device for backing up our brain's faulty hard drive. As someone once said to me, the faintest pencil is better than the strongest memory. For the last 10 years now, I have kept a journal, using a counterintuitive yet effective method. It is simply this: I write less than I feel like writing. Typically, when people start to keep a journal, they write pages the first day. Then by the second day, the prospect of writing so much is daunting, and they procrastinate or abandon the exercise. So apply the principle of less but better to your journal. Restrain yourself from writing more until daily journaling has become a habit. I also suggest that once every 90 days or so, you take an hour to read your journal entries from that period. But don't be overly focused on the details, like the budget meeting 3 weeks ago or last Thursday's pasta dinner. Instead, focus on the broader patterns or trends. Capture the headline. Look for the lead in your day, your week, your life. Small, incremental changes are hard to see in the moment, but over time can have a huge cumulative effect. Get out into the field. Jane Chen was one of a team of students in a D-School class called Design for Extreme Affordability. The class challenged them to design a baby incubator for 1% of the traditional $20,000 cost. According to Jane, in the developing world, 4 million low birth weight children die within the first 28 days because they don't have enough fat to regulate their body temperature. If they had raced into this as simply a cost problem, they would have produced an inexpensive electric incubator, a seemingly reasonable solution, but one that, as it turned out, would have failed to address the root of the problem. Instead, they took the time to find out what really mattered. They went to Nepal to see the challenge firsthand. That's when they discovered 80% of babies were born at home, not in the hospital, in rural villages with no electricity. Thus, the team's real challenge, it suddenly became clear, was to create something that did not require electricity at all. With that key insight, they began in earnest to solve the problem at hand. Eventually, Jane and three other teammates launched a non-profit company called Embrace and created the Embrace Nest, which uses a wax-like substance that is heated in water, then placed in the sleeping bag-like pod, where it can warm a baby for 6 hours or more. By getting out there and fully exploring the problem, they were able to better clarify the question and in turn to focus on the essential details that ultimately allowed them to make the highest contribution to the problem. Keep your eyes peeled for abnormal or unusual details. Maryam Seeman is an award-winning journalist from Lebanon. She recently completed a John S. Knight Journalism Fellowship at Stanford University, where she specialized in media innovation and design thinking. I asked her to share the secret tips of her trade based on her years of experience capturing the real story amid all of the surface noise. Her reaction was encouraging. She said finding the lead and spotting the essential information are skills that can be acquired. She said you need knowledge. Getting to the essence of a story takes a deep understanding of the topic, its context, its fit into the big picture, and its relationship to different fields. So she would read all the related news and try to spot the one piece of information that all others had missed or hadn't focused enough on. My goal, she said, was to understand the spiderweb of the story because that is what allowed me to spot any abnormal or unusual detail or behavior that didn't quite fit into the natural course of the story. It's crucial, Maryam says, to seek a different perspective on a given story, one that would shed the light on the topic in a fresh, different, or thought-provoking way. One trick she uses is role play. She puts herself in the shoes of all the main players in a story in order to better understand their motives, reasoning, and points of view. Clarify the question. Anyone who has watched skilled politicians being interviewed knows how well-trained they can be in not answering the question being asked. Evading hard questions can be tempting for all of us. Often it's easier to give a vague, blanket answer rather than to summon up the facts and information required to give a thoughtful, informed answer. Yet evasiveness only sends us down a non-essential spiral of further vagueness and misinformation. Clarifying the question is a way out of that cycle. Eli Cohen, Senior Vice President at Salesforce.com, was one member of a six-person team crammed into a hot hotel room at the normally tranquil Cavallo Point, overlooking the Golden Gate Bridge. For the next 3 hours, they would compete against five other teams in a business simulation. The task involved answering a series of questions about how they would handle hypothetical management situations. As the timer ticked, Eli's team was having trouble getting started. Each proposed answer spawned still more opinions and comments, and soon, what should have been a fairly straightforward problem-solving exercise had devolved into a sprawling, undisciplined debate. I was there to observe and coach the team, and after 15 minutes of this, I had to ask the team to stop. "What question are you trying to answer?" I asked them. Everyone paused awkwardly. Nobody had a response. Then someone made a comment about something else, and again the group went off on a tangent. I stepped in and posed my question again. And again. Eventually, the team stopped and really thought about what goals they were trying to accomplish and what decisions really needed to be made to accomplish them. They stopped the side conversations. They waded through all the ideas and opinions that had been haphazardly thrown out, listening for the hidden themes and big ideas that connected them. Then, finally, they moved from a state of motion sickness to momentum. They settled on a plan of action, made the necessary decisions, and divided up responsibilities. Eli's team won by a landslide. Chapter 7. Play. Embrace the wisdom of your inner child. A little nonsense now and then is cherished by the wisest men. Roald Dahl. At the end of the classic musical, Mary Poppins, the gruff and joyless Mr. Banks arrives home, having been sacked, discharged, flung into the street. Yet he seems absolutely and uncharacteristically delighted. So delighted that one of the servants concludes he's gone off his crumpet. And even his son observes, "It doesn't sound like father." Indeed, his father is almost a new person as he presents his children with their mended kite and launches into the song, "Let's Go Fly a Kite." Freed from the dreary tedium of his job at the bank, Banks' inner child suddenly comes alive. The effect of his good cheer is magnificent, lifting the spirits of the whole house and infusing the previously melancholic Banks family with joy, camaraderie, and delight. Yes, it is a fictional story, but it illustrates the powerful effects of restoring play to our daily lives. The majority of us were not formally taught how to play when we were children. We picked it up naturally and instinctively. Picture a newborn baby's pure joy as a mother plays peekaboo. Think of a group of children unleashing their imaginations, playing make-believe games together. Imagine a child in a state of what Mihai Csikszentmihalyi calls flow, as he constructs his own mini-kingdom out of a bunch of old cardboard boxes. But then as we get older, something happens. We are introduced to the idea that play is trivial. Play is a waste of time. Play is unnecessary. Play is childish. Unfortunately, many of these negative messages come from the very place where imaginative play should be most encouraged, not stifled. The word school is derived from the Greek word schule, meaning leisure. Yet our modern school system, born in the Industrial Revolution, has removed the leisure and much of the pleasure out of learning. Sir Ken Robinson, who has made the study of creativity in schools his life's work, has observed that instead of fueling creativity through play, schools can actually kill it. We have sold ourselves into a fast food model of education, and it's impoverishing our spirit and our energies as much as fast food is depleting our physical bodies. Imagination is the source of every form of human achievement, and it's the one thing that I believe we are systematically jeopardizing in the way we educate our children and ourselves. In this, he is correct. This idea that play is trivial stays with us as we reach adulthood and only becomes more ingrained as we enter the workplace. Sadly, not only do far too few companies and organizations foster play, many unintentionally undermine it. True, some companies and executives give lip service to the value of play and sparking creativity, yet most still fail to create the kind of playful culture that sparks true exploration. None of this should surprise us. Modern corporations were born out of the Industrial Revolution, when their entire reason for being was to achieve efficiency in the mass production of goods. Furthermore, these early managers looked to the military, a rather less than playful entity, for their inspiration. Indeed, the language of the military is still strong in corporations today. We still often talk of employees being on the front lines, and the word company itself is a term for a military unit. While the industrial era is long behind us, these mores, structures, and systems continue to pervade most modern organizations. Play, which I would define as anything we do simply for the joy of doing rather than as a means to an end, whether it's flying a kite or listening to music or throwing around a baseball, might seem like a non-essential activity. Often it is treated that way, but in fact play is essential in many ways. Stuart Brown, the founder of the National Institute for Play, has studied what are called the play histories of some 6,000 individuals and has concluded that play has the power to significantly improve everything from personal health to relationships to education to organizations' ability to innovate. Play, he says, leads to brain plasticity, adaptability, and creativity. As he succinctly puts it, nothing fires up the brain like play. A non-essentialist thinks play is trivial. An essentialist knows play is essential. A non-essentialist thinks play is an unproductive waste of time. An essentialist knows play sparks exploration. A mind invited to play. The value of play in our lives can't be overstated. Studies from the animal kingdom reveal that play is so crucial to the development of key cognitive skills, it may even play a role in a species' survival. Bob Fagan, a researcher who spent 15 years studying the behavior of grizzly bears, discovered bears who played the most tended to survive the longest. When asked why, he said, "In a world continuously presenting unique challenges and ambiguity, play prepares these bears for a changing planet." Jak Panksepp, concluded something similar in Effective Neuroscience, The Foundations of Human and Animal Emotions, where he wrote, "One thing is certain, during play, animals are especially prone to behave in flexible and creative ways." Yet of all animal species, Stuart Brown writes, humans are the biggest players of all. We are built to play and built through play. When we play, we are engaged in the purest expression of our humanity, the truest expression of our individuality. Is it any wonder that often the times we feel most alive, those that make up our best memories, are moments of play? Play expands our minds in ways that allow us to explore, to germinate new ideas or see old ideas in a new light. It makes us more inquisitive, more attuned to novelty, more engaged. Play is fundamental to living the way of the essentialist because it fuels exploration in at least three specific ways. First, play broadens the range of options available to us. It helps us to see possibilities we otherwise wouldn't have seen and make connections we would otherwise not have made. It opens our minds and broadens our perspective. It helps us challenge old assumptions and makes us more receptive to untested ideas. It gives us permission to expand our own stream of consciousness and come up with new stories. Or as Albert Einstein once said, "When I examine myself and my methods of thought, I come to the conclusion that the gift of fantasy has meant more to me than my talent for absorbing positive knowledge." Second, play is an antidote to stress. And this is key because stress, in addition to being an enemy of productivity, can actually shut down the creative, inquisitive, exploratory parts of our brain. You know how it feels. You're stressed about work and suddenly everything starts going wrong. You can't find your keys, you bump into things more easily, you forget the critical report on the kitchen table. Recent findings suggest this is because stress increases the activity in the part of the brain that monitors emotions, the amygdala, while reducing the activity in the part responsible for cognitive function, the hippocampus. The result being, simply, that we really can't think clearly. I have seen play reverse these effects in my own children. When they are stressed and things feel out of control, I have them draw. When they do, the change is almost immediate. The stress melts away and their ability to explore is regained. Third, as Edward M. Hallowell, a psychiatrist who specializes in brain science, explains, play has a positive effect on the executive function of the brain. The brain's executive functions, he writes, include planning, prioritizing, scheduling, anticipating, delegating, deciding, analyzing. In short, most of the skills any executive must master in order to excel in business. Play stimulates the parts of the brain involved in both careful, logical reasoning and carefree, unbound exploration. Given that, it should hardly be surprising that key breakthroughs in thinking have taken place in times of play. Hallowell writes, "Columbus was at play when it dawned on him that the world was round. Newton was at play in his mind when he saw the apple tree and suddenly conceived of the force of gravity. Watson and Crick were playing with possible shapes of the DNA molecule when they stumbled upon the double helix. Shakespeare played with iambic pentameter his whole life. Mozart barely lived a waking moment when he was not at play. Einstein's thought experiments are brilliant examples of the mind invited to play." Of work and play. Some innovative companies are finally waking up to the essential value of play. The CEO of Twitter, Dick Costolo, promotes play through comedy. He instigated an improv class at the company. As a former stand-up comedian, he knows that improv forces people to stretch their minds and think more flexibly, unconventionally, and creatively. Other companies promote playfulness through their physical environments. IDEO conducts meetings inside a microbus. In the halls of Google, you're likely to stumble upon, in one example of many, a large dinosaur covered in pink flamingos. At Pixar Studios, artists' offices may be decorated like anything from an old-time Western saloon to a wooden hut. The one that most amazed me when I visited was the one lined floor to ceiling with thousands of Star Wars figurines. A successful woman I knew at a publishing company, kept an easy button from Staples on her desk. Anytime anyone left her office, they would enjoy the childish thrill of slamming their palm down on the big red button, causing a recorded voice to loudly announce to the entire office, "That was easy." And another woman down the hall at the same company had a framed poster in her office of a children's book illustration to remind her of the joy of childhood reading. Desk toys, dinosaurs covered with flamingos, and offices full of action figures may seem like trivial diversions to some, but the very point is that they can be the exact opposite. These efforts challenge the non-essentialist logic that play is trivial. Instead, they celebrate play as a vital driver of creativity and exploration. Play doesn't just help us to explore what is essential, it is essential, in and of itself. So how can we all introduce more play into our workplaces and our lives? In his book, Brown includes a primer to help readers reconnect with play. He suggests that readers mine their past for play memories. What did you do as a child that excited you? How can you recreate that today? Chapter 8. Sleep. Protect the asset. Each night when I go to sleep, I die. And the next morning when I wake up, I am reborn. Mahatma Gandhi. Jeff sat straight up in bed in a panic. He felt as if a bomb had exploded in his head. He was sweating and discombobulated. He listened intensely. What was going on? Everything was silent. Perhaps it was a weird reaction to something he'd eaten. He tried to go back to sleep. The next night it happened again. Then a few days later it happened in the middle of the day. He had just returned from India, and at first he thought it might be a reaction to malaria medicine he was taking in combination with the Benadryl he took to help him sleep when he was jet-lagged. But as his situation worsened, he found his condition was more complicated. It was like he was experiencing anxiety attacks, but without any anxiety, just the physical symptoms. Jeff was a textbook overachiever who had a deep desire to make a difference. To give some context for this, his grandfather was an early administrator in the Peace Corps. Jeff was fiercely ambitious, driven, and committed to making a contribution to the world. He was on the board of Kiva. He had been named Ernst & Young's Entrepreneur of the Year and a Young Global Leader by the World Economic Forum. He was the co-founder of a successful impact investment fund, and he was the CEO of a global microcredit organization that was reaching more than 12 million poor families around the world. He was 36 years old and on top of his game. Jeff traveled constantly, which often made sleep difficult. His company was based in Seattle, but had offices in San Francisco, India, and Kenya. He would routinely fly to London for meetings, then to India for 6 days, to be in five different cities, to Geneva for hours of meetings with investors, and then back to Seattle for a day and a half. For 3 years, he traveled 60 to 70% of the time. On average, he slept about 4 to 6 hours a night. But at the ripe age of 36, his pace of work was starting to threaten his health and his ability to contribute. What started with the nighttime attacks worsened. One by one, each of his organs started shutting down. His heart rate was erratic. It became painful to stand up straight. He had to blend his food because he could not digest it. His blood pressure was so low he blacked out if he stood up too fast. He went to the emergency room twice. He kept telling himself he would slow down after the next deal, then the next, then the one after that. But of course he didn't. He was sure that if he just kept going, he could work his way out of this. He didn't want to face the trade-offs that scaling back entailed. But they soon caught up with him. He would be forced to cancel meetings at the last minute because he was too weak to attend, or he would give a speech but bomb it because his brain was cloudy. He started to wonder if he was doing the company more harm than good, and he definitely was. Eventually, after a clear diagnosis, he was given two options by his doctor. He could take medications for the rest of his life to deal with his symptoms, or he could disengage from everything for a year or two to treat and recover from his illness. Jeff didn't accept this trade-off at first. He was a competitive triathlete, and he thought he could apply the same logic he would to an ankle sprain or a torn rotator cuff. He boastfully told the doctor he would take a couple of months off and be back to full form. Watch. Just watch. He took a 2-month sabbatical, and to his surprise, he totally crashed. He slept 14 hours per night. Then he rested all day long. He could not even get out of bed some days. He was totally non-functional for 6 weeks. He came crawling back to his doctor and admitted this was going to take a lot longer than a couple of months. True to his word, he got rid of everything that was creating stress in his life. He resigned from his boards and decided to leave his company too. He said, "The decision to disengage was very, very difficult. I walked out of the board meeting, tears in my eyes, and said to my wife, 'This is not how I wanted to leave my baby.'" He designed a life totally devoted to regeneration and recuperation as he went through the treatment protocol. He changed his diet. He went to the south of France for a year with his family. The treatment and change in climate and lifestyle worked. With a new mindset, he began to think about what he had learned through the experience. 2.5 years later, Jeff was in Tanzania for a Young Global Leaders event with the World Economic Forum. One evening at an open mic night, Jeff was urged by those who knew his story to share what he had learned with the group of 200 accomplished peers. Through great emotion, he told them that he had paid a high price to learn a simple yet essential lesson. Protect the asset. Protecting the asset. The best asset we have for making a contribution to the world is ourselves. If we underinvest in ourselves, and by that I mean our minds, our bodies, and our spirits, we damage the very tool we need to make our highest contribution. One of the most common ways people, especially ambitious, successful people, damage this asset is through a lack of sleep. If we let our type A instincts take over, we will, like Jeff, be swallowed up whole. We will burn out too early. We need to be as strategic with ourselves as we are with our careers and our businesses. We need to pace ourselves, nurture ourselves, and give ourselves fuel to explore, thrive, and perform. In the many hours Jeff spent resting, he came to see an interesting paradox in his addiction to achievement. For a type A personality, it is not hard to push oneself hard. Pushing oneself to the limit is easy. The real challenge for the person who thrives on challenges is not to work hard. He explains to any overachievers, "If you think you are so tough you can do anything, I have a challenge for you. If you really want to do something hard, say no to an opportunity so you can take a nap." By the time I was 21, I too thought of sleep as something to be avoided. To me, it was a necessary evil, a waste of time that could otherwise be spent productively, something for the weak or the weak-willed. The vision of being superhuman and sleeping only a few hours a night was intoxicating. I even experimented with some rather drastic and unconventional ways to try to cut down on sleep. After reading a sleep study where some participants were required to sleep only 20 minutes every 4 hours around the clock, I tried it out. It was bearable for a while, but I soon found that while you can technically survive on this schedule of sleep, it has its drawbacks. For example, while I was technically awake, my brain was just barely functioning. It was harder to think, plan, prioritize, or see the bigger picture. It was hard to make decisions or choices, and nearly impossible to discern the essential from the trivial. It soon became unsustainable, but still I was determined that the less I slept, the more I could get done. So I adopted the new tactic of pulling one all-nighter per week. This was not much better. Then my wife, who did not care for this practice, gave me an article that completely shifted the way I saw sleep. It challenged the notion that sleep was an enemy of productivity, convincingly arguing that in fact sleep was a driver of peak performance. I remember the article cited top business leaders who boasted about getting a full 8 hours. I also remember Bill Clinton was quoted as saying that every major mistake he had made in his life had happened as a result of sleep deprivation. Ever since, I have tried to get 8 hours a night. What about you? Think about the last week. Have you slept less than 7 hours on any of those nights? Have you slept less than 7 hours for a few nights in a row? Have you caught yourself saying or thinking proudly, "Not me. I don't need the full 8 hours. I can totally survive on 4 or 5 hours of sleep." If you thought that right now, listening to this, you will get a lot out of this chapter. Well, while there are clearly people who can survive on fewer hours of sleep, I've found that most of them are just so used to being tired, they have forgotten what it really feels like to be fully rested. The way of the non-essentialist is to see sleep as yet another burden on one's already overextended, overcommitted, busy but not always productive life. Essentialists, instead, see sleep as necessary for operating at high levels of contribution more of the time. This is why they systematically and deliberately build sleep into their schedules so they can do more, achieve more, and explore more. By protecting their asset, they are able to go about their daily lives with a reserve of energy, creativity, and problem-solving ability to call upon when needed, unlike non-essentialists who can never know when and where they'll be hijacked by their own fatigue. Essentialists choose to do one fewer thing right now in order to do more tomorrow. Yes, it is a trade-off, but cumulatively, this small trade-off can yield big rewards. A non-essentialist thinks 1 hour less of sleep equals 1 more hour of productivity. Sleep is for failures. Sleep is a luxury. Sleep breeds laziness. Sleep gets in the way of doing it all. An essentialist knows 1 hour more of sleep equals several more hours of much higher productivity. Sleep is for high performers. Sleep is a priority. Sleep breeds creativity. Sleep enables the highest levels of mental contribution. Shattering the sleep stigma. So if protecting the asset is so important, why do we give up our precious sleep so easily? For overachievers, part of the reason may be that they simply subscribe to the false belief, as I did, that if they sleep less, they will achieve more. Yet there are ample reasons to challenge this assumption, like the growing body of research demonstrating that a good night's sleep actually makes us more productive, not less. In K. Anders Ericsson's famous study of violinists, popularized by Malcolm Gladwell as the 10,000-hour rule, Anders found that the best violinists spent more time practicing than the merely good students. His finding supports essentialist logic by showing that mastery takes focused and deliberate effort, and indeed, it's encouraging to learn that excellence is within our sphere of influence rather than a blessing bestowed only on the most naturally gifted. But it also comes dangerously close to encouraging the non-essentialist mindset of, I have to do it all, the pernicious myth that can lead people to justify spending longer and longer hours working with diminishing returns. That is, until we look at a less well-known finding from the same study, that the second most important factor differentiating the best violinists from the good violinists was actually sleep. The best violinists slept an average of 8.6 hours in every 24-hour period, about an hour longer than the average American. Over the period of a week, they also spent an average of 2.8 hours of napping in the afternoon, about 2 hours longer than the average. Sleep, the authors of the study concluded, allowed these top performers to regenerate so that they could practice with greater concentration. So yes, while they practiced more, they also got more out of those hours of practice because they were better rested. In a Harvard Business Review article called Sleep Deficit, the Performance Killer, Charles A. Seisler, the Baldino Professor of Sleep Medicine at Harvard Medical School, has explained how sleep deprivation undermines high performance. He likens sleep deficit to drinking too much alcohol, explaining that pulling an all-nighter, i.e. going 24 hours without sleep, or having a week of sleeping just 4 or 5 hours a night actually induces an impairment equivalent to a blood alcohol level of 0.1%. Think about this. We would never say, this person is a great worker, he's drunk all the time. yet we continue to celebrate people who sacrifice sleep for work. While sleep is often associated with giving rest to the body, recent research shows that sleep is really more about the brain. Indeed, a study from the Lübeck University in Germany provides evidence that a full night's sleep may actually increase brain power and enhance our problem-solving ability. In the study reported by the journal Nature, over 100 volunteers were given a number puzzle with an unconventional twist. It required finding a hidden code to uncover the answer. The volunteers were divided into two groups. One was allowed an 8-hour stretch of uninterrupted sleep, and another group received interrupted sleep. The scientists then watched to see which volunteers found the hidden code and how quickly they found it. The result was that twice the number of people who had slept for 8 hours solved the problem than the volunteers from the sleep-deprived group. Why? The researchers explained that while we sleep, our brains are hard at work encoding and restructuring information. Therefore, when we wake up, our brains may have made new neural connections, thereby opening up a broader range of solutions to problems literally overnight. Some good news for the early birds and night owls among us. Science shows that even a nap can increase creativity. In just one example, a report from the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences revealed that even a single REM, or rapid eye movement, cycle enhanced the integration of unassociated information. Even a brief period of deep sleep, in other words, helps us make the kinds of new connections that allow us to better explore our world. In a nutshell, sleep is what allows us to operate at our highest level of contribution so that we can achieve more in less time. While there continues to be a culture of machismo, when it comes to going without sleep, luckily the stigma is fading, thanks in part to a few super high performers, particularly in industries that typically celebrate burning the candle at both ends, who have publicly boasted about getting a full 8 hours. These people, many of them true essentialists, know their healthy sleep habits give them a huge competitive advantage, and they are right. Jeff Bezos, the founder of Amazon.com, is one of them. He says, "I'm more alert and I think more clearly. I just feel so much better all day long if I've had 8 hours." Mark Andreessen, co-founder of Netscape and a reformed sleep restrictor, who used to work till the early hours but still be up at 7 a.m., is another. He said, "I would spend the whole day wishing I could go home and go back to bed." Now, he says of his level of sleep, 7 hours and I start to degrade. 6 is suboptimal. 5 is a big problem. 4 means I'm a zombie. On weekends, he sleeps 12 plus hours. "It makes a big difference in my ability to function," he said. These executives are quoted in an article called "Sleep is the New Status Symbol for Successful Entrepreneurs." Nancy Jeffrey of the Wall Street Journal writes, "It's official. Sleep, that rare commodity in stressed-out America, is the new status symbol." Once derided as a wimpish failing, the same 1980s overachievers who cried lunch is for losers also believed sleep is for suckers. Slumber is now being touted as the restorative companion to the creative executive mind. To this we can add that it is also the restorative companion to the discerning essentialist mind. In another article in the New York Times, Aaron Callan, the former chief financial officer of Lehman Brothers, tells the story of how at an office party in 2005, one of my colleagues asked my then husband what I did on weekends. She knew me as someone with great intensity and energy. "Does she kayak, go rock climbing, and then run a half marathon?" she joked. "No," he answered simply. "She sleeps." And that was true. When I wasn't catching up on work, I spent my weekends recharging my batteries for the coming week. So, if the stigma of sleep still exists in your workplace, consider developing an initiative at work to explicitly encourage sleep. If that sounds radical, consider how the many benefits of sleep, greater creativity, enhanced productivity, even lower healthcare costs, have the potential to directly affect the bottom line. With this perspective, it is not so hard to imagine encouraging your manager or HR department to develop a written policy. After all, many companies have policies addressing alcohol consumption, and as we have seen, the parallels in how alcohol and sleep deprivation affect performance are real. For example, Charles Seisler at Harvard has proposed a policy that no employee is expected to drive into work after a red-eye flight. And other companies allow employees to come in late after staying late at work the previous night. Companies and leaders like these know that protecting their assets is a matter of fiduciary responsibility. Under the auspices of Book Research, I recently went to Google to take a nap in one of their famous nap pods. It was a white spaceship pod, like something you might imagine seeing on the 70s TV show Mork and Mindy, of about 20 square feet, big enough to lie down but not completely flat. It had a dome-shaped cover that concealed most but not all of my body, and as a result, I was a little self-conscious at first and wondered whether I would be able to fall asleep. 30 minutes later, as the pod vibrated gently to let me know my session was over, I didn't have to wonder. When I woke up from the nap, I could really feel how much I had needed it. I felt clearer, sharper, more alert. To use the pods at Google, there is a calendar sign-up. How many people used it the week I was there, I wondered. Of the 50 people who work on the floor where it is situated, I imagined at least 10 or 20. Wrong. According to the calendar, just a single person had taken this opportunity to recharge brain and body with 30 minutes of midday sleep. Nevertheless, even the presence of the pod is important in signaling to employees that sleep is a priority. Our highest priority is to protect our ability to prioritize. In this section of the book, we have been talking about how to explore and evaluate options in order to discern the essential few from the many trivial, mediocre, or even just good. By definition, this is a process of prioritization. It includes the challenge of filtering options that, at first glance, all look important. Yet, as the logic of an essentialist explains, in reality there are only a few things of exceptional value, with most everything else being of far less importance. The problem with being sleep-deprived is that it compromises our ability to tell the difference, and thus our precious ability to prioritize. Sleep will enhance your ability to explore, make connections, and do less but better throughout your waking hours. Chapter 9. Select. The power of extreme criteria. An inner process stands in need of outward criteria. Ludwig Wittgenstein. In a piece called No More Yes, It's Either Hell Yeah or No, the popular TED speaker Derek Sivers describes a simple technique for becoming more selective in the choices we make. The key is to put the decision to an extreme test. If we feel total and utter conviction to do something, then we say yes, Derek style. Anything less gets a thumbs down. Or as a leader at Twitter once put it to me, if the answer isn't a definite yes, then it should be a no. It is a succinct summary of a core essentialist principle and one that is critical to the process of exploration. Derek lives this principle himself. When he wasn't blown away by any of the candidates he interviewed for a job, he said no to all of them. Eventually, he found exactly the right person. When he realized he had signed up for several conferences around the world that he wasn't really stoked about, he decided to stay home and skip all of them, and in turn earned 12 days he used to more productive ends. When he was trying to decide where to live, he ruled out places that seemed pretty good, Sydney and Vancouver, until he visited New York and knew instantly it was exactly the right place for him. Think back to what happens to our closets when we use the broad criterion, is there a chance that I will wear this someday in the future? The closet becomes cluttered with clothes we rarely wear. But if we ask, do I absolutely love this? Then we will be able to eliminate the clutter and have space for something better. We can do the same with other choices, whether big or small, significant or trivial, in every area of our lives. the 90% rule. Recently, a colleague and I were working to select 24 people from a pool of almost 100 applicants to our Design Life Essentially class. First, we identified a set of minimum criteria such as can attend every class. Then we settled on a set of ideal attributes like is ready for a life-changing experience. Using these criteria, we scored each candidate on a 1 to 10 scale. The 9s and 10s we decided were obviously in. Anyone under a 7 was automatically out. I was then given the unenviable task of evaluating the in-between candidates, the 7s and 8s. As I struggled to determine which of these candidates would be good enough, I had the thought, if something, or in this case someone, is just or almost good enough, that is, a 7 or an 8, then the answer should be a no. It was so liberating. You can think of this as the 90% rule, and it's one you can apply to just about every decision or dilemma. As you evaluate an option, think about the single most important criterion for that decision, and then simply give the option a score between 0 and 100. If you rate it any lower than 90%, then automatically change the rating to 0 and simply reject it. This way, you avoid getting caught up in indecision or worse, getting stuck with the 60s or 70s. Think about how you'd feel if you scored a 65 on some test. Why would you deliberately choose to feel that way about an important choice in your life? Mastering this essentialist skill, perhaps more than any other in this section, requires us to be vigilant about acknowledging the reality of trade-offs. By definition, applying highly selective criteria is a trade-off. Sometimes you will have to turn down a seemingly very good option and have faith that the perfect option will soon come along. Sometimes it will and sometimes it won't, but the point is that the very act of applying selective criteria forces you to choose which perfect option to wait for, rather than letting other people or the universe choose for you. Like any essentialist skill, it forces you to make decisions by design rather than default. The benefits of this ultra-selective approach to decision-making in all areas of our lives should be clear. When our selection criteria are too broad, we will find ourselves committing to too many options. What's more, assigning simple numerical values to our options forces us to make decisions consciously, logically, and rationally, rather than impulsively or emotionally. Yes, it takes discipline to apply tough criteria, but failing to do so carries a high cost.